The 2006 International AIDS Conference, Time to Deliver, brought to you by KaiserNetwork.org.
We've been trying to give people time to move from other sessions to this one. But I think in fairness to everyone who was here on time, perhaps we should start. I would like to welcome you to this very, very important session, which is going to introduce us to the first systematic review of what actually works to prevent HIV infection amongst young people. I'm sure you'll all agree with me that the biggest hope that we have to both arrest the spread of this pandemic and to give impetus to any mitigation efforts that we may have and to sustain development efforts in countries that are affected by the pandemic and countries which are in the process of becoming major carriers of the pandemic, is if we can harness with our young people their tremendous energy, their strength, and their skill, and their intelligence, and their potential. Young people are the biggest resource that we have available to us as a planet. They are not just our hope, they are not just our future, they are the very essence of humanity. And we are all very, very privileged to have been given this opportunity by the young people, by yourselves, to share with you how we can support young people to take control of the future of this planet. I have a very, very distinguished panel of speakers with me. And we are very, very fortunate to have amongst us some of the biggest champions of young people on this globe, whether they be from academia, whether they be from NGOs, from amongst the young people themselves, research institutions, multinationals, governments, and some of the biggest advocates that we have been fortunate to have in the struggle against the epidemic. The biggest champion I believe that we have been fortunate to have, who is outside and who does not come, oddly enough, from the center of the epidemic, but who advocate as strongly, if not more strongly than a lot of us who come from the center of the epidemic, who shall be our first speaker, is Stephen Lewis. He has worked tirelessly with all of us from every sphere. Every soldier that is engaged in this battle knows Stephen Lewis well. I was very, very privileged the other day to join with him as we celebrated his contribution and also the contribution of the oldest soldiers in this war, and that is the grandmothers. He is the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. He previously served as Deputy Executive Director of the United Nations Children's Fund and Canadian Ambassador to the United Nations, and has been an elected representative of Ontario Legislature. Mr. Lewis's book, Race Against Time, was published in October 2005 and has served as an inspiration to all of us to deliver on our commitment. And I would like Stephen Lewis to come and introduce to us the panel for today.
Thank you immensely, Joy, and hello, everyone. I do apologize for my late prima donna entry. It was not predetermined, and it was not intended. This is a really very interesting and good document we're dealing with in this session. The fascinating amalgam of 80 different studies, which David, I think, will deal with in particular analysis after I have made these few incidental opening remarks. And the initiatives that are attendant on the studies, what works now, what could be implemented now, why the implementation would make sense under the circumstances, all of that is extremely valuable material to discuss. And in the second half of the session, you'll have to forgive me because I have a session on food security for which I shall have to leave earlier than I would have liked. But in the second half of this session, you'll get a much more apt breakdown of some of the issues. But what I wanted to try to do was to address the question of why we seem to have so depreciated youth in the response to the pandemic, why we have given them so little place in response to the pandemic, why it continues to be an unenviable problem that we can't seem to mobilize around youth as a constituency and a voice, protecting themselves and sharing that protection with others. And I hope that in the exploration of that problem and raising some of the questions about what has been left out of the studies which were appraised, no commentary on either the studies or the report, but simply what has been left out and what is crucial to consider given the context of the pandemic now, I hope that I'll be able to bestir the occasional thought. I see Bruce Dick in the hinterland there, a fellow who now works for the World Health Organization, but at one time worked for UNICEF when I was myself at UNICEF between 1995 and 1999. And I want to begin by making the observation that the premier World Children's Agency, charged with dealing with youth between the ages of 10 and 18, the second decade of youth, at the time when we were working together, and this is some 5 to 10 years after the ratification of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, UNICEF had two people dealing with what we would broadly describe as youth, Bruce Dick and Nicola Bull. And that was, in its own way, a statement about the way in which this most powerful of children's agencies on the planet was prepared to confront the predicament and the potential of young people. And that leads me to the second point I wanted to make, because the Convention on the Rights of the Child really animated, throughout the 1990s and into the 21st century, much of our sensibility about young people. And what is so fascinating about it, just to give you a sense of what we're dealing with, is that the one article of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, Article 12, which gave young people the right to a voice, the right to participation, that article was the least attended article of consequence in the entire convention. Nobody cared deeply about whether or not children really had a voice. No one cared deeply about whether or not children were really engaged, except, as I said, the two people whose responsibility it was and who had, relatively speaking, not a great influence on the organization as a whole. It was always fine when you were dealing with children in the classic definition, let us say in the first decade of life. That was fine because then countries, agencies, UNICEF could speak for them and on their behalf. But as soon as children began to develop their own voice, as soon as they began to take an assertive presence, as soon as they moved into the second decade of life and then into their late teens and early 20s, at that point in time, everybody lost interest because no one cared about dealing with young persons' opinions. Opinions were always effectively disbarred. And one of the fascinating realities of the evolution of the Convention on the Rights of the Child and the response to the Convention is that adolescents and young people and youth between the ages of 15 and 24 rarely got an opportunity to be heard. They were always an afterthought. They were always incidental. They were always a throwaway. This was true year after year. So we're dealing with a pretty potent and unpleasant legacy when we're trying to reassert the centrality of youth in the early part of the 21st century. And of course, after they reached the age of 18, when they were no longer covered by the Convention on the Rights of the Child, they had very pronounced personal views, they had very many opinions, they were divided politically, religiously, economically, sociologically, culturally. They went out to vote. They did all the things that young people do, but around which there was not very much adult encouragement or engagement. The report in front of you looks at a number of really fascinating studies, and of course the studies that are in the GO category are particularly fascinating because they have a series of recommendations which ostensibly can't be put in place now. But what I thought when I read this report and discussed it with my colleague Paula Donovan earlier today and yesterday when I met with WHO individuals, is that there's almost no disaggregation in these studies, not merely of sex, but also of non-orphans and orphans, also of orphans and other vulnerable children. We have all of these pieces of material coming out, the excellent studies that were done in the early part of the 1990s, the mid-1990s, the later 1990s, and unless I missed it completely, nowhere did I see disaggregation of orphans and vulnerable children. Now, how can you adequately implement recommendations which will make a pronounced difference in the lives of young people if you haven't taken into account this incredible and growing population in the high prevalence countries of huge numbers, torrents, deluges of orphan children? I remember making a recent trip to Kenya, to Kisumu, and meeting with one of those groups which was looking after orphan kids. And as is the normal practice when there's a visitor, you ask the orphan kids to get up and make statements. And seven young people got up. Every single one of them was in their 20s. They had lost their parents in the early 1990s, but they were orphans and vulnerable children as we describe them. And yet, of course, the entire environment in which they live has been transformed fundamentally from the days when they lost their parents. And therefore, there's a whole dimension of life which has to be studied, which hasn't yet been studied. All of the GO studies which are in this report can, of course, be implemented in what will be a fairly narrow application, because the whole world of reality is not included. I mean, one of the truths about the pandemic is that everything has changed in the last 15 years. Absolutely everything. And the studies that were in place in the early 19 and mid-1990s are frankly not applicable to orphans and vulnerable children whose presence and whose response changes significantly the way in which we might wish to implement recommendations. What about young girls who are now pressed into sexual activity as a result of the pandemic, as a result of the vulnerability? You will not find that in any of the studies. What about the young girls who have to leave school, who never enter secondary school? You will not find that in the studies. The absence of a component of life in the reality of the pandemic is something that must now be studied urgently. And isn't it interesting, as I listened to my colleagues in WHO just yesterday, that these new studies are not particularly available. We have a host of material which is applicable in a narrow way to what can be done. But in terms of reaching the very, very large numbers of children who are most vulnerable in the face of the pandemic and who are most at risk, we don't have studies which deal with their particular predicament. Back in the year 2001, the United Nations Declaration of Commitment said that by 2010, 95% of the young people should have to know how to protect themselves against HIV. And everyone in this room will know that we're nowhere near that target and we will not reach that target. And one of the reasons we're nowhere near it and one of the reasons we will not reach it is quite simply because the circumstances have changed so dramatically that we simply don't know which interventions to make and which interventions will work. I have nothing but admiration for the review of the 80 studies which have been made and their categorization in various go, ready, and steady. But I want to make an appeal that a whole new set of studies must be unleashed because the objective circumstances have so profoundly changed. There is just nothing in those societies now which is parallel to what was true in the early 1990s when so many of the studies or where so many of the studies were rooted. One of the recommendations, which makes intense sense, of course, is that schools are uniquely well placed to achieving the goal of decreasing prevalence amongst young people. But AIDS keeps young people out of school. Girls make up a very significant minority of high school students. So the poorest and most vulnerable students are not covered in the studies which we now have. And we don't have the kind of applied analysis to the objective truth which is required in order to make the responses we need. They say that young people are attuned to the mass media and that radio and print together, or radio, television, and print together, albeit no studies to speak of on radio alone, that could make an appreciable difference for young people. But since the studies were done, we have something called cell phones. We have something called text messaging. If you travel anywhere in the southern parts of Africa, those are the realities, the technological realities for increasing number of kids. They're not embraced in the studies that we've done. The fascination of the report, it seems to me, is that it gives us a glimpse of what can be. But it gives us a much greater appreciation of what must yet be done. And what must be done, and I won't knock the nail through the wall any further, is to recognize that absolutely everything has been changed on the ground. Societies are decimated, communities find it difficult to respond, the position of orphans and vulnerable children is so fragile, it is almost impossible to convey, and how we reach those youngsters with messages, those young people with messages which will make a difference in their lives and prevent actual infection and spread of infection, we've not yet found the answers to. And because the answers, as elusive as they are piled on top of a generation of indifference to the voices of young people, we have a tremendous job ahead of us. It requires analysis on the one hand and principle on the other and a kind of embrace of a youth culture which we've always disavowed. And that's going to take an Herculean effort. It is the most neglected part of the pandemic. I've always believed that the pandemic is doing such violence to women. It is heartbreaking. And the pandemic is doing such violence to children without an adequate response. It is beyond belief. And the pandemic is doing violence to an orphan population, which leaves them largely rootless and unsustained. But around youth, the pandemic has very little resonance, because youth has been so marginalized in the process of responding to the Convention on the Rights of the Child on one hand, and in the studies and analyses which we've done on the other. So I salute what you have before you, but I beg you to do a great, great deal more. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Like I said earlier, one of the reasons why we all love Stephen so much is that he's always challenging us. And like he says, this systematic review is a starting point only. It fills a gap which is such a huge void that this review in itself makes even more glaring the bigger gap that continues to exist. And this is why, when we did this review, we tried to ensure that we used the best that was available, the best researchers that could actually analyze the existing evidence. And one of the leading researchers who worked on this review, David Ross, who works for the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and has been central to the work, will present to you the study this evening. He is a reader in epidemiology at the London School. He was the director of a large community randomized controlled trial of an adolescent sexual health intervention in Mwanza in Tanzania from 1997 to 2002, and is currently the director of the DFID Supported Evidence for Action on HIV Treatment and Care Systems Research Program Consortium. And he worked together with other colleague researchers. He worked with the UN institutions, and he worked with you in the field in order to collect this evidence, and we are lucky to have him this evening share with us the results.
Thank you very much, Joy. And as she mentions, this has been a very major effort. And obviously, you know, for those of you who are lucky enough to come early enough to get a copy of the actual document, you can see that this wasn't the work of either one institution or of let alone of a few people whose names are up there as the editors of it. In fact, it was a major undertaking, lots of institutions involved, and large numbers of people, some of whom are here in the audience with us today, which is great. In terms of the objectives of what we set out to do, the main aim was to inform the choices that need to be made by policymakers and program managers when they decide what to do in terms of interventions to reduce HIV in young people. That was our major target audience. And to provide a comprehensive review of the evidence on the effectiveness of interventions to prevent HIV among young people in developing countries. And especially to start by clarifying, you know, what do we mean by evidence? And to develop and use a standard methodology for reviewing different types of interventions in different settings. And we focused on five major settings: schools, health services, mass media, geographically defined communities, and young people most at risk. It came out as this publication just last month and is available free of charge on the WHO website. It covers three major sections. The background which has an introduction and rationale for what we were trying to do, the group that worked on this, an overview of HIV among young people, an overview of HIV prevention interventions, and then the actual systematic reviews themselves, starting with an explanation of the methodology that we used, and then the reviews. And then comes to an end with the conclusions and recommendations summarizing what came out of the whole thing. Just to mention some caveats, just to stress, obviously this is not the final answer, and as Stephen mentioned and Joy echoed, this is just a contribution partway along the way about what we know, and it also emphasizes, as you'll see if you read through it, what we don't know, and the glaring gaps in what we know about what works and what doesn't work. It's at one point in time, and it will need to be updated and extended a lot. There is a very variable evidence base for different settings. In general, for example, there's a lot more studies that have been done in schools than there have been among young people most at risk. And we need to stress, that, and it's stressed in the report, we hope, that a lack of evidence is not the same as evidence against effectiveness. It just means that the studies have not been done. There's obviously reporting bias that comes into such studies. And also this review was not totally comprehensive. We were not able to review structural interventions to decrease vulnerability, interventions in the political environment, such as policies or legislation, all the potential settings, for example, prisons and detention centers, work in youth clubs, specifically were not covered, and all groups at high risk of HIV. And finally, we did not review care, support, and treatment. The outcomes that each of the reviews was looking at were based on the UN General Assembly Special Session on HIV/AIDS, the UNGAS goals related to young people. And these relate to access to information assessed most of the studies that we reviewed through knowledge, skills assessed through self-efficacy largely, services, access to services, mainly assessed through actual use of services by young people, and also goals to reduce vulnerability. And unfortunately, few, if any, data on interventions to reduce vulnerability as opposed to mitigate it were available in the literature. And then HIV prevalence. And ideally, obviously, that in this context is the bottom line. But very, very few studies have actually had data on this. And so often we needed to fall back to reported sexual behavior, which is used as acknowledged imperfect surrogate. In terms of the methodology, each of the reviews went through certain steps, and these were standardized across the different settings. So first of all, we started by selecting the main settings, and I've outlined the ones that we came up with that we were able to cover. And then within each setting, to categorize the interventions into types, based on the choices that policymakers and programs need to make. The third step in each review was to assess the strength of the evidence of effectiveness that would be needed to recommend each type of intervention for widespread implementation, the so-called evidence threshold needed. Fourth step was for each setting to assess the strength of the evidence itself for each type of intervention in terms of specific outcomes that I've just mentioned, grading the evidence using standard criteria, and to review all studies where there was a clearly described intervention and evaluation of the impact of related to any or all of the UNGAS goals. And then finally, from that review of the actual evidence, to decide if the evidence threshold needed to recommend widespread implementation for that type of intervention had been met. If it had been fully met, then that was a go. This clearly should be done, widespread, implemented. If it was partially met, then we classified this as ready, interventions that were ready for fairly widespread implementation, but need to be evaluated rigorously during that process. If the threshold was not met, but there was encouraging information, encouraging results so far, more development needed to be done on the intervention perhaps, and certainly more rigorous evaluation needed to be done, we classified that as steady. And if there were there was evidence of a lack of effectiveness or of harm for that type of intervention, then it would be classified as do not go. So just to run through what that means in real terms with a couple of examples. So thinking of geographically defined communities and interventions within them, these were classified by the authors of the paper into four groups. So interventions targeting youth specifically that were delivered through existing youth service organizations or youth centers. Second type would be also targeting youth specifically, but delivered through new systems or structures that had to be set up in order to do that. Third type, community-wide interventions, not specifically targeting youth, but delivered through family networks, or fourth type, delivered through community activities, such as special days. So then, thinking about the strength of evidence that would be needed to recommend widespread implementation for an intervention, it's clear that this will vary depending on various factors. The feasibility of that intervention, including its cost, its potential for adverse outcomes, its acceptability, both to beneficiaries of the program, implementers, and politicians and the population in general, the potential size of the effect that it might have, or could be thought to have, and the effects on other health or social benefits that might come from it. And so obviously, you're going to need to have stronger evidence for some interventions than for other. And again, just using this one of the examples that I was running through before of community-based interventions. Interventions in working through pre-existing youth-serving organizations are likely to be fairly highly feasible. They're not likely to have adverse outcomes, likely to be pretty acceptable. Potential size effect is moderate, and other health and social benefits, again, moderate. So one would need a fairly low threshold, a low strength of evidence, relatively speaking, to say this should be implemented widely. On the other hand, if you've got to set up new structures or a completely new organization in order to deliver this system, these interventions, one's going to end up through this process with a strength of evidence needing to be really quite strong, quite high. We also decided that we needed to have a hierarchy of evidence so that running from informed judgment through such as key informant interviews, adequacy or supportive interventions, where the expected changes occurred, which might come from before and after studies or time series studies. Plausibility studies, where the changes were greater than could be explained by other external influences, where usually a control group would be included. Or probability studies, where changes are unlikely to have occurred by chance, which come from randomized controlled trials. So just to give you what we meant a little bit more by the strength of evidence required being low, one would need positive evidence from well-conducted adequacy studies, so the changes that were expected or hoped to occur did occur, and at least some positive evidence from plausibility studies. In other words, these were unlikely, we've looked and we can't find an alternative explanation other than the intervention for why they may have occurred. A moderate or medium threshold of evidence would need positive evidence from well-conducted plausibility studies, unlikely to be due to anything else, we've looked and we can't find an explanation, at a minimum. And a high threshold would need positive evidence from well-conducted randomized controlled trials or quasi-experimental studies where there was a comparison group at the same time, which would add to the strength of the evidence. And then to come up with the recommendations, and I briefly explained these before, but I'll just put put them up maybe so that people can have a quick look through them. So with a GO intervention, the evidence threshold was fully met. We should be doing it. But we should still be monitoring it and still learning lessons as we do it. Through to, do not go. So a lot of work then took place by all the authors. They want me to finish, obviously. And the results I'm now going to briefly summarize for you. There's obviously a lot more detail in the report, and there will also be even more detail on the website in the future about individual studies that were included in the review, summaries of those. So in terms of the interventions where the threshold of evidence that was felt to be needed by the authors, for widespread implementation, and therefore was met fully, and therefore should be done, remembering that this is to achieve the UNGAS goals related to access to information, so knowledge, skills, access to services, use of services, decreasing invulnerability, though there was very little studies on that, unfortunately, changes in reported behavior or HIV prevalence itself. But curriculum-based sexual health education with specific characteristics that have been found to be effective in high-income countries previously and were led by adults, with or without peer involvement, the strength of evidence was strong enough to recommend this should be done. Widespread implementation. In terms of health services, interventions with health service providers, including changes in the structure or function of the facilities themselves, such as changing the times of opening or making sure that there's some privacy in the consultation for young people, and promotion of the services among young people and gatekeepers in the community. Thirdly, mass media interventions, where the messages were delivered through radio and other media, such as print media, with or without television. So both those with and those without television met the GO recommendation. In terms of interventions that are ready, in other words, the recommendation would be the threshold of evidence was partially met, and they should be implemented, widespread implementation, but with careful evaluation and ideally with a quasi-experimental design, or at least a before-after time series, proper evaluation of the outcomes related to the UNGAS goals. Geographically defined communities, interventions targeting young people using existing youth service organizations. And among young people most at risk, interventions that provide information and services, both through facilities and outreach. So in terms of what do we take from this in terms of action, there are types of intervention with strong enough evidence to advocate widespread, large-scale implementation now, so GO interventions, and others where large-scale implementation is justified with careful impact evaluation. Ready interventions. And there is a very clear research agenda. In order to move interventions which are currently in the steady category, where there just isn't enough evidence of effectiveness, to really be able to say, based on the evidence, if you do this, it's likely to be effective, to move those into the ready category or into the don't know category, where it's clearly not working. And to move the ready interventions into the GO category. And I hope that any of you who get the chance to read the actual report will look at that, and will those of you who are either able to fund research or to actually do it, will be motivated to say, hey, look, there's a huge new agenda, or clear agenda, that needs to be done to get the evidence for us as to what's effective. So in conclusion, now, compared to 10 years ago, we have clear goals and targets that have been set by international organizations, and even some of them have been ratified. We have increasing funds in countries available to actually do HIV prevention activities through many of the new sources of funding. We do have increasing clarity about effective and promising interventions, but we clearly need to get rid of the excuses, you know, that we don't have any evidence for prevention among young people. There is evidence strong enough to convince certainly the authors and editors of this report, and I hope all of you who read it, you know, that there are interventions which should be being done on a widespread basis. However, we also need just far more evidence-informed action. Far too little. Stephen stressed already, and I'm sure others will echo it, there just isn't enough being done for young people and to prevent HIV in young people. And just before the meeting, I was just talking with a couple of people about how striking it is. We always look at HIV prevalence curves. We never look at HIV incidence curves. If we look at HIV prevalence curves, you see it going up with age, and you think, oh, yeah, okay, it's the older people. If you look at HIV incidence curves, you then immediately focus on the fact, hey, if we're not doing anything in young people, we're missing the boat. So much more evidence-informed action and more careful evaluations of steady and ready interventions. So thank you all very much for your attention. And in particular, thank you all to all the people who worked so hard on making this report come to fruition.
Thank you very much, David. So for the young people, what are you going to benefit from this? Now you can say to a Minister of Finance or to a donor or to whoever, when you have a proposal, that, you know, this is a goal project, this is a steady project. It means that at the same time that I'm implementing, I'll also be doing some research in order to ensure that it's viable. And we now have a very clear gap in research agenda. Stephen is about to leave us, but before he does, I just wanted to ask any, just one young person to ask him a question. Very pointed, please, so that he can respond before he leaves. One young person. I'm not wearing my glasses, so I'll rely on our assistants there to identify the young person who can ask Stephen a question.
Hi there. Oh, sorry to split up. I'm just wondering if you could answer for us quickly, what's the difference between prevalence and incidence? Sorry, I don't want to be a stupid question, but thank you.
Okay, after Stephen has gone, does anyone want to ask Stephen a question before Stephen leaves?
Hi, my name is Beth Pelletieri, and I'm with Advocates for Youth and the Toronto Youth Force. And I guess I had a comment more than a question, and I very much enjoyed your opening remarks, and it's great to finally be in the same room about you with you, because I've heard so much and read so much. I was a little, I have to say, disappointed by your remarks, because I think that too frequently adults say that young people aren't doing enough and young people aren't being aren't around enough, but we're doing so much and there's so many active young people doing incredible programs all over the world, and so I felt like your remarks didn't address that, and so I was wondering if you could comment on that a little bit.
I don't disagree with you, and your point is well made, and I apologize to you. It is absolutely true. I mean, I take it for granted that the young people who are there at this session are activists and are in the field and are doing a great deal, and that is evident everywhere. But if we were making the kind of impact we should be making, then the huge percentage of new infections between the ages of 15 and 24 would not be taking place. And the inability to reach the 10 to 14-year-olds, where the levels of sex education and sexual awareness have to be so strongly engaged, and I have watched it myself as I traveled, that would happen in a much more widespread fashion. So I'm not depreciating for a moment all of the activities of young people. I'm just saying that we have not yet begun in the places of power, in governments and in adult communities, to make it possible for the voices of young people adequately to be heard, adequately to spread the messages of prevention, and most importantly, to know what works and what doesn't work in a way which will diminish the numbers who are being infected and dying. I mean, it's thousands of new infections every day in the vulnerable age category. And frankly, one of the admirable things about this study is the way it says these things can start now. One of the aspects of the study for which no one is particularly responsible is that all of the developments within the high prevalence countries over the last 10 or 15 years around particularly vulnerable groups, whether it's drug injecting youth or whether it's young men having sex with young men, and all of the questions around orphans and vulnerable children, all of those things have yet to be looked at in a more serious way for prevention reasons. And that's all I was attempting to say. So I'm not pretending for a moment that your activism isn't there. I'm just saying that you don't have enough support and there is not yet enough amassing of the evidence.
Thank you. And I appreciate that clarification, because I do feel that it's been one thing that keeps getting left out of some of the comments. So I thank you for your clarification.
I'm so glad you said what you said, because I was self-conscious as I was speaking to you. You make exactly the right point. In fact, you should have had the podium. Yes, go ahead.
Thanks for taking this, Stephen. Just to speak to what you just said about the lack of empowerment of youth in the places where they need to have a voice, do you think that that has something to do with the fact that a lot of the stories and a lot of the situations of the most marginalized youth are actually the stories that we don't want to hear in Canada? And if so, how do we deal with it? How do we deal with the fact that sometimes the most extreme situations and sometimes the most troublesome of circumstances of people in developing countries are the ones that we just don't know how to deal with because we don't have that experience in Canada? How do we make those issues real rather than just another World Vision commercial that people switch off when they see it?
Well, World Vision wouldn't be happy with your diagnosis. it's so interesting, because in my experience in tramping across Canada and a lot of the United States over the last couple of years, I feel as though there is a renaissance of interest and commitment amongst young people. University, community college, high schools, there's such a tremendously intense commitment. And so many young people are going into the field and doing exactly what was suggested, being activists at the grassroots and attempting almost desperately to make the changes and to intervene. I don't get the sense that it's young people are in any way compromised by what they see and hear. The compromising comes from the levers of power. The compromising comes from the absence of political leadership. The diminution in what you can actually do comes because you don't have the kind of support and engagement from the powers that be that you should have, that we should have. I mean, it's very distressing that that's the case. It's fascinating, if I may put it this way, that Bill Gates and Bill Clinton and Bono and Geldof and Oprah Winfrey and Angelina Jolie and Madonna and Richard Gere, that we are summoning this vast array of celebrity leadership in the absence of political leadership. And if you don't get... If you don't get the political leadership which, for example, truly values what youth does and can do, and particularly understands the range of interventions that might work in the developing world and studies those that we have not yet studied, if you don't have that kind of leadership, you're at a real deficit. So you work valiantly on your own and in smaller groups in the field without the kind of support you should have. And it's just an absolute truth. I mean, believe me, I was there and I watched it, and I was in part responsible for it, for which I will never forgive myself. That the second decade of life, which leads to everything we're discussing, was truly neglected by the international community in all of the years that this pandemic was developing. And so we don't have the evidence that we should have, and we don't have the engagement that we should have.
Thank you. And I just want to add that I don't think enough of our young people are telling the politicians we're serious by voting. And when that changes, they're going to be a lot more interested in what we have to say. Thanks, Stephen.
Fair enough.
Let us all thank Stephen. He has to go.
I'll go ahead. I'll do one more.
Okay. Yeah. You'll be the last one. Thanks, Stephen.
Hi, my name is Mila, and I'm here with the Toronto Youth Force and also the Global Youth Coalition on HIV/AIDS. And I think you've heard about this already, but you were talking about leadership and commitment, and here we have a new initiative called the Youth Adult Commitments Desk, which is at the Youth Pavilion. And we were really hoping that you could make a commitment to young people here and that we can follow up with that.
Okay, I it was a little bit blurred in the hearing at my end, but I gather, is this in the Global Village?
It's in the Global Village in front of the Youth Pavilion.
Yeah, the Pavilion. And are you... Oh, okay. All right, then. What am I? The sticker that was just given to me suggests strongly that I should be visiting the booth in the Pavilion.
That would be great.
You have my absolute commitment that at some moment in time between now and the closing, I will definitely visit the Pavilion and spend some time. Since I'm involved in the closing, I can delay it long enough to make the visit with you first. Thank you, everyone. I'm sorry to be leaving.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Thank you very much. We have now been given the reports. We are going to dissect it and slice it up. And we have a very, very active panel here that is going to slice it up. We will come back to the questions, my dear. We'll come back to the questions.
Well, my colleague who is deaf is something before, he would have liked to say something before Stephen walked out.
I'm sorry, he's left, but we'll give him the message. I'll give you the floor first. Okay. I'll give you the floor first as soon as our panel's list have spoken. Like I was saying, we are going to slice up the cake, really dissect it. We have a young person from the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community. We have a young person living with HIV/AIDS. We have a representative of the government, that is a Deputy Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Health. We have a representative from UNAIDS, from UNFPA. We are really going to dissect this very, very rapidly. And then you can, come back to us and tell us, you know, whether it is now in bite-sized chunks that you can actually eat, and whether it is something that you can run out of here with and use as a product for delivery. The first of our panelists who shall speak is Punima from UNAIDS. She's an internationally renowned scientist whose area of expertise includes gender issues in international health, especially in AIDS. She has worked in her native country, India, in the Population Council, and she has worked in the Global Fund, and is now the Director of Policy, Evidence, and Partnerships, UNAIDS.
One of the most difficult things to do is to follow someone like Stephen Lewis. So I think that was the reason that I was bumped up to take a little bit of the rap. No, I'm just kidding, Joy. Thank you very much for asking me to speak first in this panel. And I'm really speaking on behalf of the UNAIDS family, even though there are others from the UNAIDS family who will, of course, be speaking here. And I particularly want to thank our interagency task team on young people that's done such enormous work to bring out this document and all the efforts that have gone behind it. We've been saying for a very long time in UNAIDS and in many, many fora that, you know, today's youth are tomorrow's future. The youth are impacted upon. In fact, many of the issues that we are talking about today, even in the document that's in front of you, are probably common sense to the young people who are in the room and outside the room. Young people know the evidence, they live the evidence, and they experience the evidence. They know what works and what doesn't. Steady, ready, steady, go is just an adult distillation of that wisdom of young people. So what I'm going to focus on is just a little bit on the context, because I think it's important for us to keep reminding ourselves of what the context is for this work to happen. Talk a little bit about how this links up to the policy position paper that the UNAIDS family developed, where young people were given considerable prominence. And thirdly, the opportunities to scale up prevention for young people as part of a broader movement towards universal access. These are kinds of figures that you've seen before, so I won't go into detail, but we still have to keep reminding ourselves that HIV has become one of the largest killers of young people in the last two decades. In parts of Africa and the Caribbean, for example, young women are up to six times more likely to be infected than men. A recent report of the UN Secretary General to the United Nations talked about the progress made in the last 5 years. And it's very telling in terms of what it says about what we've done for young people and how successful we've been. It talks about 85% of national plans having a policy that promotes reproductive and sexual health education for young people. In 58 countries reporting data, you find, you know, that primary schools, secondary schools, very large percentages, between 74 to 81%, now provide AIDS education. But frankly speaking, what does this really mean in terms of the quality of that AIDS education? We don't see that data behind these figures, which are so impressive. We also have to remember that the coverage of prevention services among young people is still dismal. There is some progress, and we need to be happy about that progress. It just isn't enough. The levels are still low. I'm not going to go through the figures there in front of you that clearly indicate we're just not doing a good enough job. The evidence that is presented by Steady Ready Go papers suggests that school-based education is critical to increasing HIV-related knowledge levels among young people. You can see in this slide, for example, that the knowledge levels seem to double for young people who had received at least primary education, and the rates quadruple among young people with secondary education. I think that's an important finding. But of course, getting girls into school is also a hurdle we have to cross. We know that there are enough surveys done, for example, Burkina Faso, Haiti, Mozambique, Nigeria, countries where HIV is spread mostly through heterosexual sex, that less than 20% of young women who are aged between 15 to 24 years had sufficient knowledge, especially among those who did not get to school. On a more encouraging note, we find that the percentage of young people having sex before the age of 15 has declined, and condom use among those who are sexually active among the young folks has increased between 2000 and 2005 in 9 out of 13 sub-Saharan countries. I'm particularly mentioning the good news as well, because we often forget the good news. Now, we know that the world is not a homogenous place, and I think one size doesn't fit all, which is why the UNAIDS family developed a policy position paper. And I won't again go into the position paper, it's available widely here, but I want to emphasize what's in this policy paper for young people and how does that tie up with the Steady Ready Go document. This document says that focus on young people is imperative. Young people are most threatened and yet the greatest hope of turning the epidemic, and that meaningful involvement of young people in all aspects of planning to monitoring and evaluation is imperative. And there are key elements that have been identified, such as, and I'll just mention a few, that HIV education must be accompanied by access to life skills education and services. A full complement of tools to prevent HIV transmission, which involves comprehensive and sex-appropriate sex education, should be available to young people. Consistent access to male and female condoms is essential. Provision of youth-friendly health services. Safeguards for young people, in particular to protect them from sexual violence and exploitation. And special protection for young people in risk situations such as sex work or those in conflict situations and so on. In the UNAIDS policy position paper, we as a UNAIDS family committed to producing a compendium of evidence for HIV prevention actions. This document is in fact fulfilling the promise we made in relation to young people. And let me tell you, it's the first one that we have produced. We have a long way to go in terms of getting all the evidence out, but this is the first one, and we really applaud the efforts of the interagency task team to make it happen. This report clearly shows that prevention works for young people. It states the evidence, for example, that providing services for those most at risk among young people is absolutely effective. This is a key priority for countries with low or concentrated epidemics. I don't think with this kind of documentation, educational authorities have any room for denial, because it shows that curriculum-based interventions led by adults that are based on good quality standards can have an impact not just on knowledge, but also on behaviors and skills. The evidence around the effectiveness of mass media and a very much underutilized resource will hopefully pave the way for greater involvement of this sector in reaching the goal of 90% comprehensive awareness of HIV prevention by 2010. Now, we hope that this comprehensive presentation of the evidence and the policy position paper will settle the debate once and for all, and let people get on with the task at hand. Instead of arguing, is there evidence? Does it work? Let's get on and with the job and ensure that we can work towards an AIDS-free generation. I think we owe this to young people, we owe this to the future, and we owe this to the present in order for us to respond to this epidemic. But before I close, I'm just going to say one thing, and that is that my boss, Peter Piot, always says that evidence is critical, but there are some things in terms of values that are just as important. And there are times when, even when there's no evidence, we know it's the right thing to move. So it's wonderful that in this area, we believe it's the right thing to do, and we have the evidence too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Panima. We really appreciate your endorsement of the major contribution that young people have made and that they continue to make despite our lack of support to controlling this epidemic. I would now like to ask a young person, Ricardo, to come and give us his view on this report. He's 21 years and is a student of political science and aspires to work as an investigator of topics related to sexual and reproductive health. He has been an activist for sexual and reproductive health rights in Mexico for 6 years. He was the coordinator and co-founder and the first national group for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender young people. And he represents young people on the Regional and National Council of the Mexican Ministry of Health and NGOs working in sexual and reproductive health. He is also a student of political science. Ricardo.
Hola, buenas noches. In the first place, I want to talk about something. Perhaps most of you have been wondering who are those young people wearing the yellow t-shirts and also some adults wearing these yellow t-shirts. We belong to the Toronto Youth Force, and the Toronto Youth Force is integrated by hundreds of young people from 16 to 26 years old who came to this conference, and we are trying to promote meaningful partnership and participation inside the conference and also towards the actions afterwards. We also put all those posters all around the building with five words that I'm sure most of you have seen. Listen, money, sex, truth, and access. Those are some of the key messages that we are, as young people, wanted to get across. Listen, we want you to involve us in decision-making that affect our lives. Money, we need fully funded programs to protect ourselves. Sex, HIV is mainly spread through sex. We need access to condoms to protect ourselves. Truth, we need comprehensive sex education to protect ourselves. Access, we need youth-friendly health services, including prevention, treatment, voluntary counseling, and testing, and access to harm reduction programs. So all these messages I just read, all they are one way or another included in the Steady Radical research. And well, I'm going to focus now more in one of the chapters, and I think it's basic in this study. 5 years ago, when I was 16, I knew that condoms were useful as a contraceptive belongs to a group most at risk, such as gay men and other men who have sex with men. I didn't have any access to prevention information. So far, I don't know of many things that have been achieved to help my peers, and I also know that only pamphlets and posters are not enough to make us understand how important a specific evidence-based intervention on groups most at risk, especially young people. So, one of the main lessons we learned at the Steady Ready Go program is that if we want to prevent HIV from spreading, we need to act with and for young people, including young people who are marginalized and stigmatized. If we don't focus in these groups, we will never halt the disease. It's true that there are many regions in the world where the epidemic is generalized, but certainly there's also a lack of interventions on some groups most at risk. Since the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, it has been clear that not everyone is equally at risk of becoming infected with HIV. Many young people are particularly vulnerable of becoming infected because of the situation in which they live, learn, and earn as a result of social, cultural, and economic factors. There is a special attention that needs to be given to young men who have sex with men, young sexual workers, and young injected drug users. We know that they are not the only vulnerable groups, but for this Steady Ready Go study, there wasn't enough information available for other groups that are also most at risk. So that's why there's a focus in these three groups that I just mentioned. So now, through the review of the strategies used in Steady Ready Go, we learned that perhaps the best intervention for young people, as it was shown before, for people most at risk in developing countries so far are the ones that include outreach and facility-based services. It is important to keep in mind that good integration of outreach activities and facility-based services are necessary. Information about services must be constant and accessible, with every member targeted group having equal access to the intervention. I believe that also some of the most important findings on the cases are that all the UNGAS goals are addressed by this type of intervention. Information, capacity building, and services are provided in an attempt to decrease risk and ultimately HIV/AIDS incidence. The outreach component is a crucial aspect, helping to inform the target group about facility-based services, and that the studies in this category were successful in increasing knowledge, increasing service utilization, and also reducing the incidence of sexually transmitted infections, not only HIV/AIDS. So, interventions to mitigate vulnerability of young people most at risk need to be seen in the broader context of structural interventions made to decrease young people's vulnerability in general, So I'm saying that it's not only necessary to decrease the vulnerability of those groups most at risk, but also for all the young people. So when developing specific interventions for the sexual workers, injected drug users, and young men who have sex with men, it is important to ensure that the specific needs of young people are given adequate attention. This is sometimes is a problem because there is not enough information about what's the difference between young men who have sex with men and adult men who have sex with men. Sometimes that's the difficult part, and where their research had not enough information to have some evidence. And the other important thing that we should keep in mind is that sometimes the data is not disaggregated, so we don't know if actually the interventions are being successful for young people or only for adults or in general. So this is something that we always should do when we have when we make our evaluation and monitoring. So the epidemic has grown, or our knowledge has also grown. Now we have more advantages than before, such as this important tool to identify what works and what doesn't. There is no time and there is no money to lose. It is time to deliver. So let's deliver better better interventions for young people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. We appreciate your passion and your commitment. And we are sure that some of the research gaps that we have identified today, you will be participating in bridging. We have with us Dr. Narong Sek. He has worked extensively at various levels in the public health system in Thailand, assumed many positions in this public health system, and has made a tremendous contribution to the development of the public health system in his country. He has been Deputy Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Public Health since 1997. Dr. Narong
Sek. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, our friends. First of all, I would like to thank the World Health Organization for bringing the issue of universal access for young people with the emphasis on prevention among young people to discuss today. And I also have to thank to giving Thailand to have this opportunity to present our experience that we have learned. So I would like to present our first slide. Thailand has been facing a serious HIV and AIDS epidemic in the early 1990s. And you can see that it was estimated that the number of new HIV infections would have been as high as around 150 cases per year. Cumulatively, more than 1 million Thais have been infected by HIV. The major route of HIV transmission during the early period of the epidemic occurs among men who visit female sex workers. Based on several effective interventions, such as the 100% condom program, which focuses on the promotion of condom use among sex workers, the incidence of HIV infection has declined continuously for more than 15 years. In 2005, the figure has been estimated to be around 17,000 cases, not 150 cases that has been originally estimated, or is nearly 10 times under the estimation. However, our achievements are not last so long. Now, Thailand is threatened by the new epidemic wave of the unsafe sexual behavior among young people. Thus, we are very so worry about that, which could cause the emerging of the HIV epidemics. It can be catalyzed by the pattern of sexual behavior among young people in which a high proportion practice unsafe sex. This slide demonstrates that in 2005, around 53% of male conscripts report that they have engaged in casual sex, but consistent condom use rate in this group was only 36%. The consequence of unsafe sex, sexual behavior has been observed in an increasing number of sexual transmitted diseases. In fact, reported cases of sexual transmitted disease has been continuously declined during the past 15 years. However, the figure, which was only 10,000 in 2003, has increased to 13,000 cases in 2004 and 12,000 in 2005. More importantly, the proportion of young people aged 24 years old or less occupy 46% of reported cases in more recent years. So you can see that the case that you see in the poster, 50% of the young people get involved in this. In order to identify the most vulnerable groups for HIV infection, a detailed analysis of the annual HIV infection was performed. It was revealed that the top five groups of population who were infected by HIV during the past couple of years are discordant couple, men who have sex with men, sex workers, and intravenous drug user. Youth is considered as a cross-cutting group in all of this vulnerable population. As we review the situation of HIV epidemics in the country, we realize that the new strategies must be leveled up to tackle such emerging problems. A new national strategic plan on HIV and AIDS prevention and mitigation has been drafted, which will last for 5 years, from 2007 to 2011. This national plan covers all aspects of HIV and AIDS prevention, treatment, care, and support. And this plan has been integrated in Thailand's 5-year National Economic and Social Development Plan. We expect that by the end of this plan, our country can achieve the reduction of new HIV infection by half. This is the list of the existing intervention and strengthened preventive interventions, as you see on the slide. As a senior officer in Thailand, I welcome the findings from the work that WHO and others have undertaken to review the evidence for the effectiveness of different interventions for the prevention of HIV among young people. It will help us strengthen our new strategic plan. The chapter on school, the chapter on school and the media will strengthen our focus on information, education, and risk communication. The chapter on health service will help us strengthen our focus on prevention in the medical setting. And the chapter on community intervention and on intervention for young people most at risk of HIV will strengthen our outreach programs. In conclusion, we are convinced that the accomplishment of HIV prevention as planned will reduce the number of new infections in the future. Say that in 2010, if without the newly leveled up strategy and a stronger prevention program, annual HIV incidence is likely to be 10,900 cases. However, if the program would have been implemented successfully, the annual incidence would be reduced to only 5,300 cases. So thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Narongsak. And we wish you luck and the young people of Thailand in addressing this emerging challenge that you are facing in your country. Frika Chia Iskander has been active in the Asia-Pacific network of people living with HIV/AIDS since 2003. She contracts training in public speaking and advocacy on HIV/AIDS for young people and on women, human rights in Indonesia and in the region. She consults for UNAIDS, for UNICEF, for UNDP, for UNESCAP, and is also studying business administration and public relations at university level. Frika.
Thank you. So, should I actually just sit down, or I think I'll just sit down. Sorry. Yeah, so I can see everyone here. Thank you for the opportunity to talk here. Yeah, my name is Frika Chia Iskandar. I'm Indonesian. I'm a young person, a young woman living with HIV and AIDS. And first of all, I'd like to address that AIDS is not only an African problem. And this is something that I would like to give the message to everyone. That's why it's one of the reasons why I'm here, because I know that it's not only Africa problem. It's also other part of the world problem also. And if we see like Asia and other part of the world, prevention is still possible. So I think this is like one of why this book actually here is because we still do see that prevention is still possible. And people always ask me, why am I here? I would like to bring the visibility then, and I also want to be the resource person on what works actually. And I'm so happy, grateful to see that it's actually documented. It's on the nice document on this book on what works for young people. So I want to be the resource person. Okay, what can you guys do, let's say, if we can turn back the time to make me not being positive? And it's actually being documented in this book. And I'm really happy with that. And I really hope everyone here can actually read and see, okay, what you will do and what you shouldn't do and when you're back to your country. And when we always see the graphics, it always says that the young people are the most now being transmitted by HIV. From my personal experience, I'm now 24 years old. I was diagnosed when I was 18 years old, so I'm a young person. So I'm the kind of person that you want to reach to. But in my personal experience as an activist back in Indonesia and even in the region, in Asia Pacific, in delivering programs, I have faced so many challenges when I want to implement programs. As young people, they always see me as someone inexperienced, as someone that, oh, you're still so young, you know nothing. So when we say, I think this will work for me, and they'll say, where's the evidence? And then I'll say, I know, because it's from my experience. But how can you justify that? And sometimes it's difficult for me. And not everyone can actually justify and give the right answers. So we need something documented, like who was it saying just now that it's actually common sense? It is a common sense. But we need something that's actually visual. It's there. It's on the paper. It's in document and it's proven. It's evidence-based. So for me, as an activist, with this book, I think it will help me in me doing an advocacy. This will be one of my advocacy tools in implementing my programs. And because for me, to be honest, to have an equal partnership as with an adult, it's really difficult. Though I will be an adult soon, I hope that I won't be like the adult now, you know. So, like I said before, what I think this book can do is as an advocacy tool. And because this is the collective voice of young people, this is the review from the 80 countries, yeah, that's it. Yeah, from the 80. And I think it's really useful. And as a young people living with HIV and AIDS, I'm sure I can use this book. And I'd like to underline what you shouldn't do, just in case you don't read this completely. Like Ricardo say, when you implement programs, do it completely. So when you do it, when you want to do it only half part, you better not do it. Why? Like we say, yes, we need information, but we also need the services. When we say, okay, we can prevent HIV and AIDS through condoms, through clean needles, but if we cannot get the access, and then what for? So you need to do and implement it completely. Thank you.
Thank you, Frika. We are just about to open the floor to you so that you can give us your comments. But before we do that, UNFPA would like to share its thoughts with us. Mari Simone works for UNFPA. She's currently the Deputy Executive Director. But she has a lot of experience in this area. She has directed programs in public health, reproductive health, HIV/AIDS, population studies, gender and human rights throughout her long career. She has worked in international and in national programs. And she has a wide range of experience working with young people. And she would like to share her thoughts with you on this evidence that we have available to you today.
Thank you very much, Joy, and I'm very pleased to be part of this important and very, very timely panel discussion. I'll be brief, and then hopefully we will have time for a little bit of discussion. Maybe it's opportune that I come at the end of the presenters, because what I wanted to underscore is the what really has been conveyed by all the others is the urgency of the response and the complexity of the issues that we must bring in our response. And how we in the UN system are taking that very seriously. So I just want in a few minutes to illustrate the very practical way in which we have organized ourselves to bring the different comparative advantages and the different experiences from the various parts of the very complex UN system together so that with this more coordinated response we can be more effective. So it's an example of the importance of partnership and of the importance of comprehensive programs and trying to, with our limited means, to pull together so that we can go to scale and have more sustainable programs. So what we've done, and in fact, Purmina Mane referred to that, we, within the context of the UNAIDS and the UN system, we organized ourselves into an interagency task team. So a team for work on young people and HIV/AIDS. And it is really the purpose of it is to foster and encourage joint, accelerated, and expanded response. And I won't go into the specific objectives, but if anybody is interested later on, I can share that with you. Okay. But basically, it is to take the evidence base and a right-based approach forward, working together. And so, without taking too much time, let me just illustrate very briefly the kind of comparative advantages and the kind of things that the different partners bring on this. And it really illustrates the multiplicity or of the components that are needed and which this evidence base also brings very clearly to our attention, that we need a broad range of interventions that are comprehensive. So within this interagency task team for young people and HIV/AIDS, there are 11 partners from the UN system. And of course, there's the UN AIDS Secretariat, which provides overall coordination for the work. And of course, there's also WHO, which is focusing on prevention in healthcare settings, and VCT and STI and HIV treatment, RABs and opportunistic infections, and PMDCT. Then there are others. There is UNDP, which focuses on governance and those kinds of issues, the human rights and gender issues. There is UNFPA, which is the convening organization for this task team. And we bring to bear our comparative advantage on information and education, on condom programming, on prevention for young people outside schools and vulnerable populations and sex work. UNESCO focuses particularly on education institutions, UNICEF on care and support for people living with HIV/AIDS, orphans, and vulnerable children. There are also others, maybe sometimes forgotten. The UN Office for Drugs and Crime, which brings in the expertise on related to injecting drug users. There's also ILO, working in the workplace, and the High Commissioner for Refugees, bringing specific expertise for displaced populations, and World Food Program and the World Bank. So 11 very different kinds of expertise and trying to pull together for a coherent response. So I just wanted to, on behalf of all of us, convey our commitment to upscaling the response and doing whatever we can together to really respond to this challenge. Thank you.
Thank you, Marisamal. We have appreciated that we have really maybe saying let you down you know, my colleagues in the other UN agencies will kill me if I say that. We have really missed an opportunity. We would like to regroup and give you the benefit of our combined strength. But we know that this combined strength can only work with your strength. And in pursuit of this, I would like to give you an opportunity to ask questions. There was one question which was already asked, and there's a young lady who wanted to us to give a message to Stephen Lewis. I don't know if she's still here. If she's still here, please go to the mic. Otherwise, we will take questions and members of the panel will respond. Questions and comments, please. Yes. No. You can start, and then David will then answer the question that was asked together with yours, and we'll continue.
Okay, sorry, I don't mind somebody else going first. Who is the person?
If you want to speak, please go and queue behind the mic.
Okay, I can start if it'll make things clear.
Yes, please.
All right. My question was simply a reiteration. I have a degree in health studies, and therefore I know what a systematic review is, and I know what incidence and prevalence is. But I don't think that a lot of youth necessarily have access to that information. And so I think a really great document to supplement this document would have been sort of like a little, well, this is what this is, so that, because it's about youth. I know that the target audience isn't youth, because it's the target audience is for people who are going to take that evidence and go somewhere with it, but maybe that could be youth. So I'm just thinking that maybe it would have been a good idea to have a supplementary document trying to make epidemiological language, and epidemiology is the study of disease patterns and statistics over places and time and stuff, more accessible to you. So something that said incidence is the number of new cases rather than prevalence, which is the burden of disease. And I just wanted to know what you thought of that.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so, thank you very much for that comment, and it's very well taken. And certainly, you know, we'll be working on trying to do that to make it even more accessible. And just to quickly re-emphasize, you know, what the difference is between prevalence and incidence, and to apologize for using those terms. For example, if you're talking about a 20-year-old, then the prevalence of HIV is the proportion of 20-year-olds who are HIV infected whenever they've got it. Whereas the incidence of HIV would be the proportion of 20-year-olds who've become HIV infected in the last year. The point I was trying to make earlier was that, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, the age group with the highest prevalence of HIV would be people in their 30s. Whereas the age group with the highest incidence, the highest number of new cases per year group, is in young women who are 15 to 19-year-olds, and in young men who are 20 to 24-year-olds. So that's where the new cases are, is among young people. But of course, because it's cumulative, if we're only looking at the proportion of, say, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, 40-year-olds, who are infected as a whole, then we miss that point.
Thank you very much, David. And just to say that all the authors of this research, this evidence, are here. So that please don't be surprised if someone from the floor answers the question that is asked. Can we have the next question or comment, please?
Okay, my name is Opio Washington. I work as a program coordinator in Kenya for VCT services. So we offer VCT services to deaf group. And we've been there for like 3 years now. So I have two questions and also a recommendation. I feel this book, I'm happy that there's been so much effort that has been put in. You've tried like to look at the research and just to look at the young people. So I want to recommend that maybe as we look at the VCT services, okay, for me, I feel like the deaf have a high risk. When we talk about the book, then we need also to consider about the deaf. Because we've talked about the HIV prevalence. And the deaf in Kenya, the prevalence is 7%, which is like just the same with the hearing people. So for me, I feel that, okay, we also need to include the deaf. And like I've seen a lot of presentations and a lot of wonderful things that have been done. But I feel the issue about the disabled people should also be included, because we have people with disability and they also have a high risk. So you can say, like, we have the drug users, we have men who have sex with men, but we also want to ask, maybe, what information do you have? And also, we need also to inform the world about the deaf, and that's my recommendation and also my question. Thank you.
Could we have the next comment or question, please?
Could I go over here? Is that all right? Yeah. Hi, my name is Tanya, and I'm a member of the Youth Coalition, and I'd like to thank you for doing all this work for a systematic review, and I agree with the young presenters that this is an excellent tool for advocacy. But I am a little bit concerned that it sounds like you're presenting that the primary barriers to implementing effective programs for young people in HIV/AIDS is the lack of evidence, where from all of our experience, it is usually the moral and value-laden things that young people should not be having sex or should not be involved in these activities. And implementing these programs with the evidence can't happen in a vacuum without not in the culture that we're living in today. And I would really like to see some sort of association to policymakers, on how, especially at the UN, all those 11 institutions that you stated, at how they are discussing this with the policymakers as well, because that is just as or more important.
Thank you. Could we have another one, and then we will start responding from the other side.
Yeah. Good evening. My name is Lavanya. I'm a part of a youth run organization back home in India, and I'm also representing the Toronto Youth Force here. My question was actually for Purnima Main, but since she's left, I'll address it to Mary. Are these UN agencies trying to include young people in deciding the kind of prevention program designed for them? If yes, please elaborate how. If no, why not?
Okay, thank you. We'll just respond to these two and then these few questions and come back to you. David, do you want to refer any questions to your colleagues?
Yeah. And Doug, would you like to come up for a second? Just while he's coming, related to the evidence, the issue about evidence is not the only thing that makes people decide to do stuff. And that is very well recognized, I hope, within the report, and certainly well recognized by all of us. However, we do need to know as much as we can, you know, does stuff actually work? We can throw an awful lot of money away on things that don't work. But also, policymakers want to have that evidence that they're not going to do that. Doug, would you like to add?
Can you hear me? Is this on?
Yes.
The previous question, the person made a very good point, which is that it's not just evidence. It's also people's values and their concerns. And it is very much true throughout the entire world that many adults do fear that if we talk to young people about sex, if we encourage them to wait until they're older, but if we also talk about condoms, tell them how to use condoms, encourage them to use condoms, tell them where to get condoms, that then young people will be more likely to go out and to have sex. And although I think that may be a reasonable concern, the reality is that it's not true. It's not valid. This review and other work that we've done has summarized the impact of many studies which have looked at the question, if we talk about condom and contraceptive use, as well as encouraging young people to abstain, do we increase sexual behavior? And many studies have demonstrated very, very clearly that we do not increase sexual behavior. We can do both. We can both delay sex and reduce the number of partners and increase condom contraceptive use as well. So it's not a mixed message that's confusing to young people. Rather, it's a very reasonable and very clear message that can have a positive impact on all the behaviors. And I think with the evidence in here, we can help make that point to people and help alleviate that concern that some adults have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Madison?
Yeah, thanks, George. Yeah, I'm very happy about the issue that was raised about young people's participation in the programs. And obviously, yes, this is a definite commitment of the UN system. It goes without saying. Those for whom supposedly programs are designed must be part of the design, the governance, the implementation, the monitoring. So definitely it's a commitment. Now, reality is not always perfect, so we still have to work on it so that we can make sure that we have a really, truly meaningful participation. And it is respectful, you know, of the views. Like, you know, we heard other colleagues here who are mentioning that oftentimes young people are perhaps not taken seriously, so it's a token participation. And this is something that we have to work at, all of us. But definitely the commitment is there and the provision for it also, that we must make it happen even more.
Can I just add? Thank you for that. It'd be great if we could make some time to come down to the commitment desk in the Youth Pavilion. That's in the Global Village. And probably put it down, because that's what we're doing. We're just getting our leaders to come down, come to us, and give it to us. But I think I'll give you a sticker in return. And all our support, which is already there.
Thank you very much. David wanted to make one comment before we end the lunch.
Yeah, in answer to the gentleman who was mentioning about the deaf and people with disabilities as a group who need particular interventions and much more attention, very much endorse that. There are many groups that there just wasn't the studies there that haven't been looked at. And that partly reflects that there just haven't been the interventions. And certainly, you know, the people with disabilities, but also in particular perhaps groups in prison and detention, young people in detention centers at particular risk. There really aren't the programs, there are some, but there aren't very many, and there certainly aren't the evaluations of what's effective to learn the lessons about what best to do. So fully endorse what you were saying, the need for that.
Thank you very much. That is an important gap which we definitely need to fill.
Hi, my name is Emily Wilson, and I'm a volunteer at the conference, but I've spent the last two summers working for an NGO in Ghana that targets women and vulnerable young people. And as a youth advocate, I'm kind of concerned with the top recommendations that were given a go on page 327, and kind of backing on that question, that none of them seem to actually state that they're going to involve the youth in these initiatives. The school programs are led by adults, the health services are involving making changes in the structure, and I just kind of wanted to point that out, that implementing programs involving empowering the youth is a huge tool, and I just don't think it should be overlooked.
Could we have another?
Hi, Mila here again from the Toronto Youth Force and the Global Youth Coalition on HIV/AIDS. My question is for the Public Health Minister of Thailand. Given that the report addresses vulnerable groups, including injection drug users, I'm wondering how the recommendations of the report are going to be applied in Thailand, and whether they will be applied at all for young injection drug users.
Another one, please. Thank you very much. Another question.
Hi, my name is Lonnie from the Board of Youth Co-Aid Society in Vancouver. My question is geared towards the physician from Thailand. Forgive me, I've forgotten your name. From your PowerPoint presentation, the survey you've done, it was unclear whether you distinguished between male sex workers and female sex workers. Can you clarify that? Thank you.
Can we just respond to these few, and then we'll take the last batch of questions?
For Thailand, say that we both government and say that the private group. Government support a lot for the NGO to work because we have learned that if we have our officer to touch this issue, we cannot gain trust better than the NGO group. So for us, we support a lot for the NGO to move and work closely with us. As I have mentioned, we use plan as a flag, like a flagship. And by this plan, it's not top down. It's a bottom up. all stakeholders come together and discuss what are our problems and what we need to solve and how to do it. And then we plan it together. And we use it as a common plan that we have agreed together and present this to the government. And as I mentioned, we upgrade from the Ministry of Public Health plan to be included in the national economic and social development plan. That means we can, the government or the country has committed already to support or to ensure that the resource will be support and all the stakeholders, especially from the government sector, to join it. The Ministry of Education, Ministry of Commerce, Ministry of Interior, all ministers has to join and use this plan together. So this is why we are quite sure that we have a lesson learned from 15 years ago, and we can do a good job. But the time changed, the problem changed. We cannot use old tactic to solve the new problem. That's why we have to alert. And monitoring and evolution is a very important tool for us to keep our eyes crossing and tap into the problem when they change. So this is what our country is trying to do, and we are doing now. Yes. For female sex worker, we have a well-established preventive program for her already. But for the male, say that we, as I mentioned, after we have learned that the threat is increasing in the alarming signal for us, especially in the tourist area. Say that in Bangkok, in Chonburi, which we have Pattaya, in Phuket, and in Koh Samui, Surathani. Then we move in and we try to motivate to have the group of this M&M to participate our preventive program. And they respond quite well. And this we will extend more and say that we will work more intensively to use the participative program with this group, and we hope that in the near future we can cover all the country.
Thank you very much. David, do you want to comment or any of your colleagues want to comment on the points that were raised earlier? While you are still thinking about it, can we have more questions or comments, please?
We are standing under the air conditioning here. My name is Moises. I'm with the Planned Parenthood Federation and with the Youth Coalition. First of all, I feel really proud of being represented in the table by those two youth speakers. I think they were excellent. And a question to Dr. Ross. I'm looking forward to reading this study. I don't know whether you encountered any initiatives that were based on capacity building and sexual reproductive rights on the HIV incidence in any kind of population. We know that evidence based is not the only important thing, but that value based education is also important. But I would like to know whether you encountered any of these initiatives or whether you didn't study them because you didn't think they were appropriate.
Thank you. Could we have someone from the other side, please?
Hi, my name is Marco, and I'm from the Global Youth Coalition. Thank you for taking out the report, but when I was looking at it, I was a little bit disappointed because as I look at youth is a very wide scope. So you have prevented for youth who are not HIV positive, but how about youth that have become positive? What kind of resources are there for youth? because, I mean, we are also at risk of STIs and many other things. So is there something that is going to be done so that that could be done within this report or within any report?
Thank you for that important question. Could we have...
Hi, my name is Joylyn. I work with the City of Toronto with youth, and I'm also a youth from India. And maybe this question would have been more directed to Ms. Mani, but she isn't here, but, so that's okay. But I just wanted to ask the question that I know that there's a lot of outreach work being done in all parts of the world, and in India especially, but to reiterate that point that she made, since the focus of this conference is time to deliver, when this book goes to the governments and the policy makers, is there some kind of accountability that you guys are asking for in implementation of these policies? Because I know that in certain parts of India, there can be outreach work done, but especially in North, Northeast, there can be a lot of outreach work done, but people look up to some of their leaders over there, and those leaders are not willing to accept that some of these social concerns are there. They are not willing to accept that young people are having sex at an early age. They are not willing to accept homosexuality and various other social factors. So my main question is, how are you going to make the governments accountable when you present this document to them?
Thank you very much. Important, very important question. Could we have the last question, please?
Good evening. I'm Don from Cardiff University in Wales. Well, congratulations for a book for being able to compile all the studies and experiences. But if you would go home and read the book, and even just scan the executive summary, you might be a bit dismayed that all the recommendations have already been mentioned for the past decade. There's nothing new. I think that it's good that we're able to compile. So probably it would have been also best to find out what has been the evidence, why all these recommendations, which have been recommended 10 years ago already, if you scan it, have not been implemented. I think that's one more important thing with the book. Secondly, I think it would have been also nice, you know, we're trying to give more responsibility to the young people, but there has been no recommendation or anything that would mention the accountability of young people also in doing these programs.
Thank you very much. David, can you try and share the questions with your colleagues?
Start out, and others perhaps can help me. So the first question about capacity building and sexual and reproductive health rights. As I mentioned briefly, one of the areas that we had hoped to be able to have a specific review of evidence on was like structural type interventions or interventions to reduce vulnerability through the political arena, through policies and through legislation. And in fact, two successive groups were commissioned to actually do that review, and both found that the actual documented evidence out there of what the impact of different legislation, for example, or different policy statements was, is extremely weak. Not weak in the sense that it doesn't have an impact, don't get me wrong. I certainly believe that it's incredibly important, but it just hasn't been well documented what happens when you make such new policy decisions. And so, and also similarly, some of the structural interventions, there's just been a recent trial reported which did try and look at linking sexual and reproductive health education to microfinance initiatives, for example. But that's very, very recently been reported. There's been very few structural interventions that have actually been evaluated that way. So please, let's make sure that we do more of those evaluations so that we will have the evidence as to how they work. How will this be used by governments? If I can skip to that one, because maybe Marco's question we can come back to. But accountability of governments, will it be used?
this, we have to be a bit humble as scientists, I think, in the sense that we have to do two things, but we can't actually hold people to account as scientists, except by showing people that if you don't do anything about things that have been recommended, you won't get good results. The first thing that we have to do is to produce evidence for people, and all that we were doing in this initiative was to actually compile the evidence and review it systematically. Lots of studies have been done by lots of people, which were what we were building on. And then secondly, we have to make sure that the findings of our studies and our evidence do get out there in a way which is accessible to the people who need to make the decisions and also the people who are affected by those decisions. And so a lot of effort, this is just the start of this initiative in the sense of getting the report out there, getting the summaries out there. Right now, it's just happened. But now we've got to do lots more to get the information out there in the most accessible way to the people who will really make the decisions. And then later, we need to then push the kind of agencies and the population as a whole to hold their governments accountable. Others may well want to add on that.
This point, I think, is very important that support with, because say that David Bloss, something like an external force can create awareness. But this awareness, if no internal response, you can do nothing. So these are both ways. So both ways mean that for the internal, your system, your organization, your collective group, that's the most important component that you must have in your internal organization. And you have a connection with external. That's the international network that we come here. This is a kind of international linkage or network. So for the external, the data or the information is really macro. It's just like a linking bell. And you have to come to your house or your home and look at your data, your information, or your evidence, whether this problem really occurred, or you really concern this problem or not. But no way, the political, internal politics system, they cannot accept that they would not accept that they must not accept what's tried to push them from outside, no. So it seems to me something like a mutual action. For external, create some awareness to the internal. The internal has to realize and then respond that appropriate, that feasible, that acceptable to your country. So that's the point.
Yes. Yes. I think I want to bring everyone in this room to this point. You know, this book is not the answer to everything, right? I mean, but I think we have to give like some credits to the people who are already documented and make it like a more, at least another step ahead, rather than, you know, we have nothing in hand, nothing in book, nothing in documentations. I think we should clap to the people who are, you know, doing this. Please give a credit, you know? Because I think when we are talking about partnership, I think we also have to, you know, give them, okay, this is actually can work. But in other hand, it is also important that maybe we can do the evaluation. If this, when you go back, okay, can this work or not? If not, or maybe we should add something or what? I think we can do that, yeah, David? And I don't know, Bruce or Jane, and then maybe can email and then give like some more recommendations. And also like for the guy, Marco, yeah, when you said young positive, I do agree with you. I do agree. But I think there will be another series. I think there will be the book two.
Joyce, can I just
Yes, very quickly, I think.
Very briefly.
I
think the issues that were raised, many of the issues that were raised, really pinpoint to the importance of programming for young people in the context of the national plan. So where you have a national HIV/AIDS prevention plan, young people's needs must be there, front and center, and not in little, you know, projects here and there. Or if you have a national sexual and reproductive health program, young people's needs must be there. So, you know, this must be seen in a broader context of how governments and national counterparts work, you know, for overall programs and not little projects. That what the evaluations bring is evidence which can be used when people are not convinced about the importance of involving young people or programming for young people. So it's a tool where, you know, to convince those who are not yet convinced, and also to have some evidence for good program design. And obviously it needs to be, you know, many more studies and many more evidence base is needed so that we can expand the response.
I'm afraid we have exceeded our time. I was told that we should be out of here at 1:15, and we are way beyond 1:15. And I would like to
somebody's take question was not answered. Marco's question was not answered.
I was going to answer it because I see that the questions which I was going to answer was the one on prevention for positive youth, which Marie Simonen tried to answer, I mean, did answer to some extent. But also, just to say that this evidence, we could not do it for everything. At the beginning, we had hoped we could, but as we started the process of actually reviewing the evidence, we had to limit it just to prevention, and we know that there are other gaps, but this is a starting point, and we will continue to try and fill the other gaps together with you, and we are aware that since that this is only the beginning, it also places a lot of burden on us and on yourselves. When Marie Simonen was introducing the 11 UN agencies, the agencies do not have the authority to hold anybody accountable. Governments, the peoples of any country have the authority and the mandate to hold their governments accountable. But what we can do as agencies is to make the information available, to act as a, maybe for lack of a better term, as a watchdog, and to assess progress and to make this information available to you, the people, who can hold your governments accountable. So, I mean, we can play a certain role. The role that we can play as UN agencies is we can continue to advise the governments, we can continue to advise the stakeholders, we can continue to support governments and stakeholders in implementing the results of this, support you no matter what stakeholder you are in the development process. But holding governments accountable is the responsibility of the people who put that government in power. And we would really like to appreciate the suggestion that you have made, that this needs to be made. We need to translate this into a document that will be suitable for young people. So that what is it that this systematic review is saying to young people? What does it have for them? And without risking being murdered by my colleagues, I would like to commit to doing that. We will find a small group amongst us who can translate it for young people. And we really appreciate this exchange. It has been a wonderful opportunity for us, and I'm sure the reviewers have really enjoyed interacting with you. We look forward to using this evidence as leverage, as a starting point, as a launching pad for further delivery for the youth, and addressing the other groups that this particular review has not been able to address, primarily because the evidence does not exist. So we need to create that evidence, and I think this gives us the ammunition to go and create that evidence. I would like to thank our distinguished panelists and our very, very distinguished young people, those in the panel and those in the audience who have participated in this panel, and thank all the reviewers who have assisted us in this, and thank you too for what you have been doing for young people, and continue to urge you to continue to work together, because a lot of you have said, the people who are actually going to win this epidemic for us are the young people, and we have the confidence that they will win the epidemic, the war against the epidemic for us. Thank you very much for your...